Welcome to PodX Med, the official podcast of the Academy of Extreme Environment Medicine. Shannon, we met a few months ago on a boat off the Great Barrier Reef, and we had some awesome discussions about a topic that I wanted to get you on the podcast to talk about today and some of the experiences that you had in the past. Now, Shannon, tell me and tell our listeners a little bit about your clinical background.
What we talked about was that, so I trained in South Africa, and between working in Australia and leaving South Africa, I worked on cruise ships as a doctor. So that was what we were talking about. So in terms of just a bit about my medical career, I grew up in Johannesburg, so I studied medicine there as a postgraduate student. I actually wanted to be a forensic pathologist, but then I started doing clinical work and kind of fell into critical care, and I've never really left. Used to spend my Saturday nights in the emergency department, and I've stayed there. So still spend my Saturday nights in the emergency department.
Yeah, great.
I actually finished med school back in 2012, and I worked in a place called PE Maritzburg in KwaZulu-Natal. If you know South Africa, that's one of the more rural provinces. PE Maritzburg it's like a large central town. It's got a complex of three hospitals, but it's mainly the referral center for the whole surrounding regional and rural area. So that was where I did my junior doctor time, is like the Australian equivalent. It's a hard place to work, but a good place to work. When you do 2 years of internship and then a third year of what's called community service. So I did my 2 years in PE Maritzburg, with like a really wide kind of experience, lots to learn from people who'd worked there for a long time, but it's quite a difficult system to work in, understaffed and under-resourced. You see a lot of like injury and trauma, a lot of like non-communicable diseases, and like as well as a huge HIV, AIDS and TB burden. But I kind of, after doing that, in my third year, I got allocated through a lottery system to an emergency department job in a Johannesburg urban emergency department. That's kind of the year where doctors are usually allocated to rural areas, and you often have to practice independently, sometimes being the only doctor in the hospital at times.
Sure.
So I was lucky to, I've always wanted to do emergency medicine. So when I preferenced my choices, I picked an ED, and that's where I ended up. And so I did 12 months of emergency medicine and a postgraduate emergency diploma that year. But there was a lot of stuff going on kind of in my experience of the medical system that was pushing me towards needing a break.
Sure.
So I know before we spoke a bit about like the challenges of working in the South African system. And obviously this is my experience. I don't speak for everyone. And I know my colleagues, we've all experienced different levels of hardship, but I just found that I was like really struggled with the like injustice of the system, and that there's a lot of inequality in the healthcare system there, and that no matter what you did, even with the best intention, you couldn't deliver the best care. And kind of the things that came to mind would be like, I'd have a patient who would frequently represent in DKA because they didn't have electricity at home to keep the insulin cold.
Wow.
And it didn't matter like good you were at your job. There was just things that were, and so the quite like high levels of moral injury. And then as everyone knows about South Africa medicine, there's a lot of like interpersonal violence, and a lot of that falls to the work of the emergency department, which I think when I was younger was quite like exciting and challenging, but it just got harder and harder as time went on, and I lost the like enjoyment that I was having. And so towards the end of my third year, I was looking for a way out, like what could I do next year that would give me something else, give me a break. And I'm a very much an advocate for mental health and like workplace well-being. And at the time, there just wasn't psychological first aid available or debriefing available to us.
Yeah,
and
sure.
So it's unfortunately, that's it's kind of the reason for my looking for other ways to work or other ways to use my like medical degree, and that's part of the reason that I ended up working on cruise ships.
Yeah, wow. So my next question was about the differences between South Africa and Australia, but you've touched on a few, and it sounds like there's some far-reaching social challenges that really affect how you can deliver the medicine within the emergency department. You've had some time in Australia and you've spent a lot of time in South Africa. The medicine within the emergency department, what else is different between the two?
So I think that so as a practitioner, you learn to be independent very early on. So from a personal point of view, the difference, you know, as a medical professional is that in Australia, there's a lot more support. The roster is going to be a lot fuller. You know, most people outside of night shift, you're always working in a lot of places with a emergency physician, whereas I would have been the most senior doctor, like in the department some days.
Yeah, wow.
at a fairly like junior level. The difference being that you come out of medical school in South Africa really knowledgeable and clinically skilled because that's the job that you're trained to do.
Yeah, sure.
So you do have you get given the tools to do it, but I think it doesn't mean it's not hard. You're also working it's fairly low resourced or under resourced depending where you work. I was in a smaller place, so not in a big tertiary center. And some days you just don't have the things that you need to do the job, and you make a plan because the patient needs the care. And so you kind of, instead of delivering the gold standard, you deliver the standard that you can achieve with what you have.
Yeah. And you've basically described medicine in extreme environments is you need that ability to be to work with what you have, and that may not be necessarily what you're used to having, and being able to be a real autonomous clinician and make decisions and deliver medicine without the support that you may be used to.
Yeah, I agree. I think I learned a lot of skills there that have like the clinical skills that I came out of that training I've held on to and have benefited me like ongoing forever. I just, when people ask me, oh, wasn't it exciting to work in the emergency department? I always say that those clinical skills came at a cost.
Yeah.
And it's always important because those clinical skills came at a cost of the patients experiencing those illnesses and that trauma, as well as the clinicians looking after them.
Sure. Yeah. So you finished up your career in South Africa. It's time to find a new way to do medicine, a new way for you to move forward. And you look towards cruise ships. Did you think you'd end up working on cruise ships, or how did you find the job? How did you find yourself on a ship? What were those first few months like?
So, So at the end of my third year of practice is kind of the year where you start making decisions about, are you going to apply for a registrar post? What are you going to do? And I had decided early on that year that I didn't think that I was going to stay in South Africa the year after, and that I needed a break. My initial thought was I'd go overseas for a year and then come back and carry on with emergency medicine training. At the time, well, this was in end of 2015, beginning of 2016. So the options for alternate work would have been NGOs, like either in Africa or overseas. The only country you could work in without writing license and exams was the Republic of Ireland, and a lot of South African doctors went there. The locum system in South Africa wasn't that robust and wasn't really an option, and I wanted to travel. And so what I actually ended up doing was I knew a few people who had worked on cruise ships, and it's a fairly common pathway for South African doctors. There's various reasons for that, but one of them is that we have like knowledge and clinical skills at a kind of younger career point than, for example, say a specialist from the US. And so the cruise ship companies like hiring South African doctors. And so what kind of happened is I applied for jobs in Ireland. And then I also looked at cruise ships. And in 2016, I had gotten accepted to be a volunteer at the Rio Olympic Games.
Oh, wow.
And what that required is that I needed 2 to 3 months off around the time. And no job in Ireland would give me that time. So it was a matter of finding a job that matched that.
Yep.
And so the cruise line recruiter said, that's not a problem. You can do 2 4-month contracts. You can have the 3 months off in between. And so I was like, oh, okay, that's an easy choice.
Yeah, great.
So I signed because, you know, it was my 1 year of stepping out of and so I signed up. The minimum you have to sign up for is a year, which is 2 contracts.
Yeah.
And the general pattern is 4 months on and 2 months off. And I was, you know, they attract you with the travel and the adventure and the opportunity to like, practice medicine in a really unique setting. And I ended up doing it for 3 years.
Oh, wow.
That's incredible. That's great. So 2016, you've got your first job on a cruise ship. And where was that cruise ship based out of, that first one?
So that first, I joined the ship in Cozumel in Mexico. It took me like 2.5 days to get there. So I flew South Africa, land to somewhere in Europe, and then to France, I think. Then I flew across to Atlanta and then had to wait and then fly into Cozumel's an island off the coast of Mexico. And then you stay another night and then you join the ship the next day. So you do these massive trips, sometimes 2 or 3 days. Between either before or after a ship, or sometimes you get moved between ships. So yeah, so I joined my first ship in Mexico. That would have been about March of 2016, and that ship's current itinerary was to do Panama. I'm trying to think, Caribbean and Panama Canal, I think, around about there. Yeah.
Yep. That's great. So you're off in Mexico. And we're starting on a cruise ship. So tell us, how does healthcare work on a cruise ship? When you think about a cruise ship, right, it's probably got plenty of resources, but you're just very remote. Your ability to kind of, in a sense, no pun intended, ship patients off to other specialties or for other interventions outside of your department is quite difficult. So tell us about kind of some of the challenges of working on a cruise ship and healthcare on a cruise ship and how the governance and the system works.
Yeah, so I think that's you hit the nail on the head there, is that it's this really fascinating system where you're both like resourced in staff to a point, depending on how big your team is, and in staff, but you can be remote. The furthest you can be is like 5 to 7 days away from the nearest like tertiary hospital. And so it's an interesting way where you can do a lot at the beginning and then there's this like lag time of the next step.
Yeah.
But in kind of like to take a step back, like, so I had a quick look before I jumped on because I had to remember some of the legislation. But essentially, like cruise ship medicine, it's governed by a guideline that's written by ACEP, which is the American College of Emergency Physicians. And they've got a policy guideline that states like the minimum requirement for cruise ship medical facilities. And it also is divided by how big the ship is. So the smaller the ship, the less you need, and where the ship's going. So the more remote you go, you need different things. And the thing about that is that each cruise line is responsible for their own medical facilities, and they're different between different ones. And yeah. So the standards can be quite different. And then there's multiple other agencies at play. So the public health aspects are covered by the public health departments of each country you go to. So in the US, that's US Public Health and the US CDC, as well as there's laws that are governed by the waters that you sail in.
Okay.
That, for example, while the ship's in Australian waters, you're governed by Australian laws. But then as well as the flag state of each vessel. So each vessel is registered in a different place. So at any one time, you could be navigating 3 or 4 different sets of laws at the same time as most of those laws not having direct medical specifications. And so some of it's up for interpretation.
Okay.
As long as you're delivering like an acceptable gold standard of care within the guidelines that have been set. So I think the one thing I always make sure people know is that the healthcare delivered on a cruise ship is private healthcare.
Sure.
And that means that it's paid. And I think that that's sometimes something that runs people into trouble. It's not covered by health insurance. It's not part of your cruise. And unfortunately, getting sick on a cruise ship is expensive. you dying on a cruise ship is very expensive.
And that happens?
Yeah, definitely. There's a morgue on board. Deaths happen. We can, when we have a bit of a chat about the medical stuff, it's like being a doctor, a rural generalist for a town of 5,000 people. If it's going to happen, it can happen. I reckon if you got a whole bunch of cruise ship medical team members together, you could cover every pathology by someone's story of this happened on this ship that I was on.
Wow. So nothing's paid for in a sense. So you get patients that come and say, hey, I've got an infection, and they think they're getting free healthcare because they paid a few thousand dollars for their cruise, and the cost is in addition to anything they paid.
Yeah, so the cost. So essentially, when you present to the medical center as a patient, you sign a consent, and you're told up front, just like going to a GP, you're told up front what a consultation cost is, and then you sign consent for a consult, and then based on what treatment you need, you're allowed to have that decision about whether or not you do or don't want it. That's non-emergent care. When it comes to the case of delivering emergency care, there's absolutely no discussion of costs whatsoever, and that's all sorted out afterwards.
Sure.
And most companies are fairly, that know what, there's, I think people think that a lot of cruise ships are out there to make money, but it's not at all the case. It's about covering costs. And an interesting thing that people probably don't know is that the medical center doesn't essentially make a profit, but it uses the income to cover the crew's medical requirements.
So the crew on the boat can get free healthcare.
Yeah.
Oh wow.
So it's probably like just to chat a bit more about how the actual center is set up. So the size of the medical team is dependent on the size of the ship. So like the smallest ships will have a single doctor and a nurse, and the biggest ships can have up to 3 doctors, 5 nurses, 2 to 3 paramedics. And I mean, you've got sometimes, 7,000 people on the big ships. Mm. I mainly worked on ships that had 2 doctors, 2 or 3 nurses, and 2 paramedics. And the care is divided into like your routine care and your emergency care. So you've got your emergency response system, which functions in that there's always a paramedic or a nurse who's a first responder, who carries like, a phone or a pager, and they can answer calls from anyone, either someone calling themselves, and there's an emergency line on the boat, just like 911, on land.
Yeah, sure.
And those nurses and paramedics have an extended scope of practice in that they can treat it within that guideline and prescribe. And if the patient wants to see a doctor or a doctor's call, then the on-call doctor's called in. That's kind of the middle ground. In the case of like a life-threatening emergency, there's a medical response tannoy. So someone will report to the bridge saying medical response team with this location, and that will go out like ship-wide, no matter the time of the day or night, and the entire medical team responds, whether you're on call or not. Those are usually recesses or drownings or any severe life-threatening, and most of the time they do tend to happen in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
So you go to bed every night with your scrubs next to the bed and some slip-on shoes, because sometimes you wake up and you just run down the corridor. I remember being at a formal dinner, and the female uniform requires you to wear high heels, and we had a medical response, and I was running down a corridor in my bare feet to I don't even remember what the case is, to get to a medical response down there. But I think what's, to go back to the crew care, like the majority of the work, because there is a section of emergency, but majority of the work is kind of run out of the medical center, which functions like a GP clinic.
Sure.
So it's set up with a crew and a passenger area that has like a morning and afternoon walk-in clinic. It's got a procedure room. We've got a pharmacy. We've got a laboratory, which does a lot of point-of-care testing. So I think a lot of people would be familiar with things like iStats, and we can essentially do almost all routine blood tests. And then there's a lot of infectious diseases point-of-care testing, like malaria, that can be done.
Yeah.
There's an X-ray system on board, which is all the staff get trained in using that, and they're digital. So there's a 24-hour remote reporting service that follows up on those. And that's the outpatient section of the clinic. And then the what I call like the inpatient section is essentially every slightly differently set up, but you have the capacity to have one ICU level care bed, which includes being able to monitor manage a ventilated patient. And you've got two other monitored beds with like inline monitoring that's goes to the nurse's station outside. And then you can have anywhere from another 2 to 5 ward level unmonitored beds where you can admit patients to. And so the interesting thing is that you're able to deliver ICU level of care, but for how long can you do that with what equipment and what drugs you have? And you can't disembark someone to, it has to be to an appropriate level and appropriate place. And that doesn't always mean that's the next stop.
Yeah. Well, talking about that a few months ago about how you don't want to lessen the level of care that the patient's receiving. So if you're going to a country that doesn't have an ICU and you have a ventilated, intubated patient, then can you really offload that patient there, or do you have to find another destination for them?
Yeah, so essentially the blanket rule is that you cannot ever disembark someone to a lower level of care than what you can provide on board. And some of the places that ships go to, for example, in the Pacific Islands, the ship is sometimes the highest level of care available. So then that becomes a decision, and it's a joint decision between the captain and the doctor and then operations in the head office about whether you keep the patient on board or you, for example, have the ability to fixed wing retrieve them somewhere. So it's really every single case is different because there's factors, multiple different factors that are involved.
Did you have many circumstances where you had really sick patients that you had to hold for a number of days and that changed how you managed them or what their outcome was?
So I think there's one that immediately comes to mind of a patient. So we were doing a ocean crossing of about 5 days, and the patient had a traumatic head injury on the second day. Hmm. And so we don't have the ability to do any kind of neuroimaging, which limits your ability to make your next management decision.
Sure.
The other things that we don't have enough medication on board to keep someone intubated and ventilated for 5 to 7 days. So you have to consider that. And with that patient specifically, there were some concerns about difficult airway and what would we do if we had an airway problem. Mm. The decision was to maintain the patient sedated but not intubated. And those are things you just don't do on land.
Yes, 100%.
And you have to make decisions that you, with all the considering all factors, which I think, like you say, is not unlike working in remote or austere environments.
100%. And that's something that I think a lot of clinicians have never really thought about or thought they needed to think about, is that idea of, do I have enough medicine to hold this patient or do an intervention for the amount of time that I'm going to be with this person? Now, we're so used to having endless supplies of, sedation and endless supplies of saline or whatever drug it is. It's unusual to be working in an environment whereby you have to physically think about, well, do I have enough of this stuff to do what I want to do?
Yeah. And I think when you talk about saline, that specific case, with a head injury, this patient developed SIDH and hypernatremia, and I was working with a brilliant doctor at the time who, we didn't have hypertonic saline on board, and we didn't have the ability to give sodium without the fluid, which the patient was already showing features of heart failure. So, which was a background thing that he had. So this doctor literally sat and thought, how else can we give sodium, and ended up calling the chef, getting a chef's scale and a kilo of kitchen salt down from the kitchen, and mixing basically hypertonic saline and giving it by the NG, which is No, there's no evidence for that. But you have to think outside of the box.
Anecdotally, do you think it did anything for your patient?
I don't know. I think that in the end, the patient had an unsurvivable intracranial hemorrhage. But what we had in front of us was the numbers that we needed to treat, if that makes sense.
Yeah, sure.
We had to deliver the level of care to the pathology that was in front of us with what we had.
That's certainly a good way to think outside the box.
And then the other thing that also, which I think is relevant, is that when you've got a small team, being able to deliver one-on-one care 24 hours a day is actually quite complicated. And you have to think about people's fatigue and the impact on the service delivery to the rest of the medical system.
So did you have a dedicated night shift in a sense, or is it all on call?
So the way the call system works is, so the doctors and nurses have a slightly different, but you've always got a doctor on call day and night. And then with the nurses, they also have a roster. One person's allocated in clinic, one's on an off day, and one's the on-call first responder. It depends, but for something like that, then we essentially went to a 12 hours on, 12 hours off ICU shift. But doing that for 4 days with three people is hard.
Yes, that would be very.
And then another kind of personnel thing that we sometimes run into is, if we do need to disembark a patient, in the rare instance, you sometimes have to send one of your medical staff with them. Mm-hmm. And you then have to make a decision about, one, who goes and what the impact then on your ability to run the medical center if you lose a doctor. So I've had to send a doctor with a patient who was HELI-backed. There was an influenza outbreak in the mid-20 teens. There was a very unwell influenza A patient who was intubated. And the team that came to get the patient didn't have them. They were able to take the patient from a transport point of view, but not able to deliver the level of medical care they needed. So we needed to send our second doctor with, which meant that left me, the solo doctor, on board for about 2 days. So you have to think this. That's why I think I've just enjoyed it so much, is there's so many moving parts and so many things to consider. It's a challenge every time.
Were there any countries that you were surprised by the level of care that they could provide?
I think that the places that always surprised me were Central America. They have a very robust private healthcare system in Mexico, places like Costa Rica, because a lot of the US go to those countries for private healthcare, which means that the system is quite well set up to accept patients from cruise ships.
Wow.
So so every port has an agent that is your local person that has the local knowledge, and you call them up and say, I need a hospital that has this, and they go, oh yeah, that's that hospital, I'll arrange it for you, we'll send an ambulance. Or I had a crew member who needed to see a cardiologist, and you phone them up and they go, yep, I've made you an appointment, you can see the cardiologist when you arrive tomorrow.
Wow.
That fascinatingly, that doesn't happen in Australia. When you come into Australian ports, the most difficult thing is that if you need patients to have some kind of specialist care, the only way is to send them through emergency departments of the places that you go to. Or there are some services now which are starting to offer kind of like a service to the cruise industry to allow access to imaging and specialists within the time frame. Because sometimes you arrive in a place at 8 o'clock in the morning and you leave at 4 o'clock. So you cannot, nothing that you do can delay the ship.
Yep.
So if you need someone to see a specialist, or even sometimes you need an X-ray or a CT of something, and the only option is to send someone to the emergency department, you know that's not going to take 4 to 6 hours. And so you have to decide whether or not sending the patient to the emergency department, with the risk that they don't make it back to the ship before the ship leaves,
okay,
is something you have to make both passengers and crew aware of, or not sending them and waiting for the next option, depending on how acute the illness is or what they really need.
It's an interesting puzzle, because you wouldn't want to send a patient off for a scan or try and get them into an appointment and their ship leaves. That creates far bigger problems.
Yeah, and when you do disembark people, even if it's for something smallish, the usual pattern is you disembark them as if they're not coming back.
Yeah, sure.
Because there's always the chance that they're not, and it creates more problems if half their stuff is on board, or if their partner's on board because they thought they would make it back, and then they're now stuck somewhere. And we don't. And I think it's really important that no one should ever feel like they've been abandoned in a port in a foreign country. So there is a lot of like background work that goes into making sure that people are looked after once they have access to medical resources that they need, and then helped, you know, followed on then, whether that's home or back on the ship. Or because some people do disembark and come back on a ship. I disembarked a patient in Dubai who had a incarcerated hernia, who had surgery in Dubai, recovered, and then joined the ship a week or 10 days later.
Yeah, wow.
So it does happen.
That's great. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
So you find, do you think that Australia is one of the like harder countries to kind of access into the healthcare, or?
So it's really interesting because from an emergency point of view, it's great. So from a disembarkation point of view, depending on where you are in Australia, you know, like Sydney HIMSS, Life Flight, Care Flight, are usually the providers that go out to cruise ships to disembark patients by helicopter. And so that part is accessible. The ambulance part is easy because you call 000 and you ask for an ambulance, but the specialist part is difficult.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, it's hard as an Australian person who lives in a city to access a specialist with a reasonable waiting time. And then sometimes dentists is another big referral that we make. It's probably the most common crew referral is dental care, which is also falls under the doctor's scope of practice, is you do a bit of emergency dentistry, and you've got a dental kit on board that you're trained in. And I mean, sometimes accessing an emergency dentist is also not easy. And so some places have developed a system of where they actually have, they know what days the ships are coming in, and they've got a dentist allocated to that day. And you almost like pre-book the patients in, rather than waiting for an emergency dentist in a place where you know that there isn't one.
Yeah, I like it. Sounds like a good business opportunity. Specialists, on-call specialists for our cruise liners.
Well, there is a I know of one service provider in Sydney which is working with the cruise lines, and I actually really support that. I think that sometimes, you know, it works for certain things like orthopedics, like if someone needs an x-ray and a plaster, and that's what they, you know, because we have the ability on board to do plain film x-rays and a back slab.
Yeah.
But if you want someone to have an orthopedic review and say, that's great, we'll put a fiberglass cast on, come back in 6 weeks, they can come back on board. There's no reason that they can't. And if you're able to do that, that's a really good example of, an injury or an illness not preventing someone from either carrying on their contract or coming back on board as a passenger.
That's great. Now, I remember one story you told me of the makeshift morgue.
I'm not sure I can tell that story on here. I would say that so every ship has a morgue and 2 to 3 beds or trays.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, people do demise on board. It happens. You're dealing, in terms of your patient population, it just entirely depends where you are and where you're sailing. And you can, some areas you're sailing with young families and young, healthy people, and other places you're sailing with older people with chronic diseases who have a high risk of dying, whether they're on the ship or on land.
Mm.
And so when that does happen, obviously it's unfortunate, especially if it's an unexpected. But there are a lot of public health laws around the requirement for maintaining I wouldn't know the guidelines, but maintaining a space in which you can like safely by law store a human remains. And on some ships, the newer ships are built with dedicated morgues in the medical center, but the older ships, the one that I was telling you about, it's the refrigeration is shared with other parts of the ship that need to be refrigerated, like the food and the flowers. And so sometimes when the refrigeration has a problem, you have to make a plan to move products out of certain fridges so that you can safely store the remains.
We'll leave that up to people's imagination, I think.
Yeah.
So, Shannon, can you tell us about a case that was particularly challenging or where you had to work quite closely and collaboratively with another healthcare team from a country that you weren't used to working with?
So a lot of the time, the interactions we had with other healthcare services would be around our like most critical disembarks. And the one that everyone gets very excited about, but actually don't happen that often, are the helicopter evacuations. The ships that I worked on, they are all winch evacuations. There's no helipad.
Yeah.
And actually, majority of the time, the ship is too far away for a helicopter to reach. We're just too far from land. You've got a few hundred nautical miles of distance that you're actually within helipad space. There's a patient that I've never forgotten and who we had a medical response in the middle of the night to an adolescent who the mom had gone in to check on and had been found unresponsive in the bed. The child did have a background of a development disorder and previous seizures. And I think in retrospect, we think the child likely had a seizure and a period of hypoxia. Mm-hmm. I had an incredible paramedic who I was working with at the time. He was the first responder who said the child was in arrest when they got to the room and activated a medical response. So we resuscitated the child on the floor of a cabin, basically with four bunk beds, managed to achieve ROSC, and then child needed to be intubated and ventilated. And then this happened in the middle of the night, and then we brought back down to our medical center. At the time, we were off the east coast of the US, but we were actually too far away for a Coast Guard helivac. But they happened. The way it works is you notify the Coast Guard of your current medical situation and you just you leave the operations up to them.
Sure.
And they come back to you and say, sorry, you're too far. Call us when you're within this range. But they came back to us and said, we've actually got a US Air Force battalion that's training in the area and they have the capacity to come and get this patient. So that took the whole day to arrange. And in the late afternoon, we had two Black Hawk helicopters and a refueling plane come out to us to a predetermined meeting spot. Two Air Force doctors winched down, secured the patient, intubated and ventilated in their equipment, and then winched back up. And because there was a second helicopter and it was a child, the father was winched with and they departed. And later on, we got some photos of the helicopters refueling midair on the way back, which is pretty incredible. The child was taken back. They happened to be from the city that the cruise was ending in, and their specialist team was at the hospital that they were taken to. And after neuroimaging, they had an unsurvivable, like, hypoxic brain injury.
Wow.
But the family chose to donate the organs. And about a couple of weeks later, we got a letter from the ICU team that looked after the patients, basically telling us that that the organ donation and the retrieval is what made, basically saying that the resuscitation and the retrieval that we were able to facilitate is what made the organ donation possible.
Wow.
And that if the child had stayed on board ventilated until we had made it to land by ship, that wouldn't have been possible. And they sent us like a list of what was donated. And I think that was, it still kind of makes me quite emotional.
Yeah.
Just knowing that, like, while the child didn't survive, like that, and that took, you know, multiple agencies, multiple personnel, to facilitate that whole retrieval. And there was a good outcome, even though it wasn't the one that we expected.
Yeah. Wow. Shannon, before we go, there's one final question that I want to ask you, and that is, what skills and attributes do you take into your role now in Australia as an ED registrar that you learned from your time in the cruise industry?
I had a laugh when I was looking at this question because one of my consultants always tells me that I learned a lot about toes and feet because we used to look after a lot of crew with toe and feet problems. So she always finds me and says, oh, this person's got a toe problem. You can sort it out. But actually, I think the most useful skills were just being innovative and learning that you don't have everything that you want at all times, and you just have to make a plan while still maintaining like a level of care that we, like our patients deserve. The SHIP environment, both within the medical team and the greater as a SHIP as a whole, is extremely multicultural, and your team changes multiple times in a contract, and you can join your SHIP on your first day and go to a medical response that night with a team that you've never worked with before. And I think that's not uncommon working in ED, or if you work in the like hospital where you go to calls on the ward and you're meeting that team for the first time as well. So I think that was a skill that I really liked. And I think just in general, the broad scope of practice, from it's just doing simple things to the highest level of critical care, you can do everything in one day. So being a generalist is a skill in itself. And I know it's a bit of a cliche, but when you're on ships, you realize that you just have to do every day as if you're not going to get another chance, because sometimes that might be the only time that you get to go to that place. And so one of my favorite memories is we had a 5-day crossing into Hawaii with three critical patients by the time we arrived. We arrived in the middle of the night, offloaded three critical patients. I had a few hours sleep, and then a few hours later I was like on a helicopter tour flying over like the lava fields of the Volcanoes National Park on the Big Island. And for some reason, the pilot was playing Enya. And I just had a real, like, I might have been a bit tired and delirious, but just like those 4 days of three critical patients, that's all worth it.
That's great.
Right. And those are the things that you don't like forget. So you just know that like this might be the only time you get to do something. So it kind of changes the way you think about things. Because you could go, oh, I'm tired, I'll just sleep or not. Yeah.
Got to get out there and see the world.
Yeah. Yeah, I went to over 50 countries in 3 years.
Wow.
The only place I didn't get to go to was Antarctica, so I'm still planning to do that, hopefully as a ship's doctor at some point. Crossed the equator, went to the Arctic Circle. My first sail into Sydney was at about 4 o'clock in the morning with an intubated patient. So I never got the true like Sydney sail in the morning with the view, but I can get that on the Manly ferry. So
100%. Oh, that's great, Shannon. Thank you so much for coming on today. It's amazing insights. So if you've got any questions for Shannon, send us an email and we'll get you in contact with her. But until next time, see you later.